The U.S. has once again miscalculated its oil plans, and none was more evident by the outreach it made at places otherwise unthinkable. Yet, it failed to see that the New World Energy Order was taking place. It was a geopolitical alignment that the U.S. was hoping for, reaching out to Venezuela, a sanctions-destroyed U.S. adversary, and an afterthought for the Biden administration. The Biden administration did not even recognize the Maduro government officially. Yet, it may now ease sanctions in return for pumping more of its oil. Yet, the U.S. may have a sinister plan in mind: drive a wedge, or better yet, pull Venezuela out of Russia's orbit. The less allies, the worse for Putin. Yet, that was a long shot. Then comes another communication the U.S. made with what it considers allies, and that was to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, but that also fell short. According to multiple sources, Saudi Arabia and the UAE leaders did not even return Biden's calls, dashing hopes for Biden asking for their contribution to the oil glut. Additionally, Biden was hoping to get a united front against Russia with these two countries. U.S. attempts, however, have come out short. Saudi Arabia has long been disappointed with deteriorating relationship with the U.S. since Biden was sworn in, but it has had a good relationship with Russia. More and more West Asian nations, like Saudi Arabia, have realized that the U.S.'s focus outside of West Asia means they have to align themselves more to where their interests lie. And that means in pivoting to the East. The U.S. confrontation with Russia may be something that it is gearing up to do against China. Saudi Arabia is most likely well aware of that and will not risk its relationship with China. After all, China is Saudi Arabia's top economic trading partner because China is the biggest importer of Saudi oil. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are the dominant economic players in West Asia, and that plays an important factor in not only their alignment, but other countries in the region as well. Both countries account for more than half of the region's imports and exports. This may pave the way for other countries to follow their lead. That does it for me for this section of the program. Until next time.
The world as we know it may have changed because of the Ukraine conflict, practically as soon as the operation started. At least that is what it seems like, but that is a misconception, since the geopolitical shifts have actually been happening for quite some time. To say that a new world energy order is emerging from the Ukraine conflict, that's true, but Europe has realized it can't accompany the U.S. on this energy decoupling from Russia. And all the signs are there that the U.S. will be left out in the cold, since Russia and many other countries, including the EU, are gravitating more and more towards the East, with stronger alliances formed as a result. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you. Always looking forward to your suggestions or your questions. From Mikhail Tahwei and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next program.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Nowruz, inspiring altruism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Spring teaches us to be unselfish and share what we have with other human fellows. Spring spreads love and kindness everywhere. Let us make ourselves similar to spring. Let us make others happy and make them smile. Psychologists and behaviorists maintain that man cannot be happy unless he makes others happy. The sun teaches us to spread mercy indiscriminately. Once our being is put at the service of other fellow humans, we should be sure that God has chosen us. In other words, we deserve His mercy and favor to give others what God has given us. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "When you are doing a good act, do not look to whom you are doing it. Rather, do the good act with disregard, because even if he does not deserve your good act, you deserve doing good." Human life passes very fast, so we had better make the best use of our opportunities to let others taste happiness. Imam Reza, peace upon him, says, "Doing good acts is an eternal saving. If the rich think of the livelihood of the poor, human emotions will grow and the society will be more consolidated and security will prevail everywhere. Once the culture of helping other fellow man prevails in the society, the doers of good acts will feel internal calm and satisfaction, and more importantly, God will be pleased with them. Kindness and friendship are the two divine virtues. When a human being helps others, he is in fact doing a divine deed. Thus, he will be a truly representative of God on earth. Nowruz is a good opportunity to get out of our selfishness and consider the problems of others as our own problem. Islam believes that individuals are the members of one family and they should interact with each other. They should be concerned about the calm and comfort of other fellow men. A very famous hadith from Imam Ali, peace upon him, reads, "Like for others what you like for yourself, and dislike for others what you dislike for yourself." Islam teaches us that spending one's assets only for worldly affairs will cause great loss. But if the assets are spent for lofty affairs, one will reach salvation both in this world and the hereafter. Verse 148 of chapter Al-Imran of Noble Quran reads, "So Allah gave them the reward of this world and the fair reward of the hereafter, and Allah loves the virtuous." Doing good acts will make the society happy. God says in verse 29 of chapter Fatir, "Indeed, those who recite the book of Allah and maintain the prayer and spend out of what we have provided them secretly and openly expect a commerce that will never go bankrupt." Dear listeners, such a commerce with God will surely have no loss and will lead the individual to paradise. Nowruz provides the chance for such profitable trades. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "He who spends with a short hand will receive from a long hand." The long hand here means the vast infinite mercy of God, which will pour upon the doers of good acts. In view of this, no matter how little our good act is, God will increase it through His favor and will reward it manifold. Verse 18 of chapter Hadid reads in this regard, "Indeed, the charitable men and charitable women and those who lend Allah a good loan, it shall be multiplied for them and there is a noble reward for them." If we try to change everything for Nowruz, it is better to change the life of the needy and the poor through filling their financial gaps. God says in the Quran that whoever does a good act, there will be tenfold reward for him. Certainly, trade with God will be very profitable. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, whenever you become poor, deal with God through spending alms. Dear listeners, we should take care that the most important condition for spending and doing good to others is sincerity and purity of intention. It means that we should spend only for God's sake and not to please others or to expect the gratitude or praise by others. God says in verse 195 of chapter Baqarah, and spend in the way of Allah and do not cast yourselves with your own hands into destruction and be virtuous. Indeed, Allah loves the virtuous. Nowruz is among the best times in the year to be considerate of others and to practice altruism.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abrabah Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched in the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. But the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, to Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories, and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand in recent days. Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted again Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up, but it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stirred up controversy after suggesting that his country could lead the world. Speaking at a business roundtable meeting, Joe Biden referred twice to, quote, a new world order. The phrase quickly became a trending topic on social media on Monday. On the surface, a new world order means a dramatic paradigm shift in international affairs and a change in the balance of power at the global scale. But what the U.S. president didn't consider when uttering those words was the connotation they carry with them. New World Order has for years been used by conspiracy theorists to mean a situation in which a secret cabal of governments take matters into their own hands to form a multinational totalitarian and oppressive regime. Which definition Biden might have been going for is beside the point. The main issue is that he took it upon himself to lead the world. The statement is a fundamental rejection of the world's multipolarity.
We have to always bear in mind that those who are in power, the hegemonic powers of the world, in particular the United States and their European allies, as well as the Zionist entity, they're always planning and always plotting, if you want to use that word, on how to further increase, how to maintain, how to strengthen, how to bolster the power that they already have.
How can the U.S. and its Western allies sideline their rivals, including Russia and China, that are superpowers? The West has been announcing new sanctions against Russia since it began its special military operation into Ukraine. Russia's financial and energy sectors have been under the West's crosshairs.
We are determined to continue to impose costs on Russia to bring about the end of this brutal war.
But Russia was already under sanctions before the conflict even started. This has had many speculating that the West might have been looking for an excuse to increase pressure on Moscow.
These people, these people in power, and I'm talking specifically the United States here, they are trying to get rid of these hurdles, which they consider to be very bothersome impediments to their power projection. So the United States at this moment is trying to completely get rid of the national sovereign powers that still exist in the world. For example, Russia, China, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, you know, all sorts of countries that are refusing to bow down and to accept the globalist world order. These countries are now in particular being targeted.
But such pressure would backfire at those imposing them too. The most basic example is the EU's reliance on Russian energy. At a time when the bloc faces an energy crisis and soaring consumer prices, sanctioning a major producer of gas, oil, and wheat doesn't seem like a sound plan. Russia isn't sitting idly by. Moscow has been planning initiatives to cushion the blow of sanctions on its economy. President Vladimir Putin announced this week that his country has drawn up a list of, quote, unfriendly countries that need to pay for their energy purchases from Russia in rubles. U.S. President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office, promising to bring back diplomacy and to reverse his predecessor's misguided policies. 14 months into his presidency, however, he is following in the footsteps of the Donald Trump administration. How much longer will it take for the U.S. to realize that the unipolar world is no more?
U.S. President Joe Biden has claimed that his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall and that the Russian leader did not anticipate the strength of NATO's unity in supporting Ukraine. This is despite Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky lashing out on a regular basis against the North Atlantic Alliance's lack of support for his country in the face of Russia's military operation. Nevertheless, Biden claims Russia's accusations that Kiev has biological and chemical weapons means Putin is considering using them himself in the Ukraine conflict. The White House has not provided any evidence to support Biden's claims.
Turn the tables around and begin to accuse the accuser, so to speak. This is a classic case, classic situation. So now they, rather than sort of trying to justify themselves, what these labs were doing there, why were they sponsored, what kind of research they were doing, they turn the tables around and say that Russians want to use it as a pretext for some attack.
A senior American defense official speaking to reporters on condition of anonymity has acknowledged that Washington has no concrete information of a Russian chemical or biological weapons attack. It just happens that Biden's accusation comes after Russian forces stumbled on what Moscow says are U.S.-funded biological research facilities near the Russian border, and asked the White House to explain why it financed a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens. It's not the first time America has leveled accusations concerning the use of chemical weapons as a pretext to militarily intervene in other countries. Perhaps the biggest example is the case of Iraq, where American officials presented alleged intelligence that Baghdad was in possession of weapons of mass destruction, which led to the disastrous US-led invasion of Iraq that killed more than 1 million Iraqis. In Syria, Washington and its Western allies claimed the Syrian government used chemical weapons, and America attacked the Arab country despite evidence later emerging that terrorists who the Syrian government had been fighting were the ones who staged the false flag operations. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons even announced the Syrian government's chemical stockpile had been destroyed. There are now concerns Washington will use similar false flag operations in Ukraine.
Really inhumane thing to do. It's immoral in terms of kind of lying and trying to blame the other side for your own faults, for your own, you know, sins. But another one, it will just simply escalate the whole thing, because to make this kind of fake attack will probably poison and destroy people, and it will just strengthen Russian resolve and Russian anger.
Biden says that Putin knows there'll be severe consequences because of what he described as a united NATO front, but did not specify what actions the alliance would take. Some cracks have appeared in the NATO alliance, in particular among European countries.
NATO already did all it could. I don't think it will come down, to some kind of exchange of nuclear arms. But I think it's basically we continue in this war of, in the court of public opinion. So the idea and the purpose of the NATO is very simple. To justify their existence, that they're good, they're a force of goodness, as opposed to their opponents, be it Syria, be it Iran, be it Russia, their opponents are so bad that they are willing to utilize every nasty thing in the book, and that's what we want to do. So it'll be a victory primarily psychological.
In such cases, the issue of timing tends to come up. Biden's remarks come amid peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. The talks haven't been as smooth as many would wish. Nevertheless, there are negotiations which, for some odd reason, the Biden White House is not supporting. And that leads to the question as to why America and some of its Western allies are not backing the ongoing efforts to end this conflict peacefully.
With the conflict between Russia and Ukraine ongoing for over 3 weeks, Turkey is playing a significant role to de-escalate the tensions. The country is hosting high-level discussions between the two sides aimed at reaching a ceasefire, expressing readiness to host talks between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia. In the meantime, reports suggest that the United States has informally suggested that Turkey send its Russian-made S-400 missile defense systems to Ukraine to help Kiev with its fight against Russian forces. The report suggests that American officials have floated the idea with their Turkish counterparts, but no formal request was made. The idea was also mentioned during Deputy State Secretary Wendy Sherman's visit to Turkey earlier this month. That seems too convenient for the U.S. and its Western allies that have been asking Turkey to abandon its Russian-made air defenses and instead use American-made Patriot counterparts.
Yes, it's exactly the same system that they complained about earlier, but the political geometry has changed a little bit, so the United States is trying to turn things around to try and bring Turkey closer and to separate it a little more from Russia and to overcome the debacle for the U.S. that the Turkey's purchase of these missiles created earlier.
Observers say Turkey will almost certainly reject the proposal, but the fact that it's even being offered reveals the West's opportunistic policies. Turkey signed a multi-billion dollar agreement to acquire several batteries of Russia's S-400 missile defense system in 2017. The West wasn't pleased with the deal, arguing that installing such systems in a NATO country would potentially compromise the security of the military alliance, as well as pose a risk to the newly developed F-35 fighter jets. The first batch of the Russian-made system was delivered to Turkey in 2019, enraging the West. Former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions on Turkey over the incident and cut Ankara, a financial and manufacturing partner, from the F-35 program. Turkey has demanded repayment of some $1.4 billion it put into the program, but so far hasn't received anything back. Turkey stresses that it opted for the Russian system as the Western-made counterparts were not offered to it at agreeable terms. The U.S. suggestion that Ankara send its S-400 missile defense system to Ukraine to shoot down Russian fighter jets, apart from the technical hurdles of delivering and installing them, would potentially risk a Russian blowback. Washington has certainly predicted that any deterioration of ties between Ankara and Moscow could harm Turkey's position as a neutral broker and derail the ceasefire talks. That raises some serious questions about the U.S. stated willingness to end the conflict in Ukraine as soon as possible.
Felicitations at the beginning of a new Iranian year, Nowruz. Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
The fourth criterion is diligence in the face of the enemy. We should know the enemy, and we should be sensitive in the face of the enemy's moves. Those who were on the front lines during the Sacred Defense era know that there were some individuals within our bases who followed, with the help of their agents, every small move made by the enemy. Then they would focus on it. Imagine that the enemy has made a particular move. They would ask, what is his goal and why did he do it? They used to find a reason. They were diligent towards the enemy's moves. We should know the enemy and identify his plans. We should be diligent about his plots, his words, and his statements. And we should find an antidote for the poison that he will probably use. And we should be ready to foil his move. This is sensitivity in the face of the enemy. Well, what is the opposite of this sensitivity? One is that some people deny the existence of the enemy. When we speak about an enemy, such individuals say, you are suffering from an illusion or an illusion of conspiracy. In my opinion, bringing up this illusion of conspiracy is a conspiracy in itself.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In order to decrease sensitivities, they say, who is the enemy? Or which enmity? They deny the most obvious things. What we are saying is that America is the enemy of the revolution. It is the nature of global imperialism to show enmity towards a system such as the Islamic Republic. Their interests are 180 degrees different from each other. Global imperialism is about treachery, waging wars, creating and organizing terrorist groups, suppressing freedom-seeking groups, and exerting pressure over the oppressed, such as the oppressed people of Palestine and countries like Palestine. This is the nature of global imperialism. Take note, it is 100 years now that America and England have been pressuring the people of Palestine. They have been doing so before the formation of the Zionist regime in the year 1948 and after that, till this day.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
In the limelight.
Madeleine Albright, the first woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of State, died on Wednesday, 23rd of March, at the age of 84. We now present you an article written by John White, an author and political commentator based in Scotland. The piece is titled Madeleine Albright, a War Refugee Who Created Countless War Refugees. Madeleine Albright is dead and no right-thinking person will mourn her passing. The first female U.S. Secretary of State and former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Albright's legacy will forever be dominated by her barbaric defense of infanticide during a 1996 interview in which, when on the subject of over half a million Iraqi children dying as a result of U.S.-led United Nations sanctions, she was asked if the price is worth it. Madeleine Albright said, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." Such casual cruelty and callous disregard for the lives of Iraqi children was and remains completely in keeping with the cruelty and barbarism of a Washington-led empire that has been a brake on human progress and development for far too long. Yet, though Albright's rebarbative defense of infanticide may have guaranteed her a first-class ticket on a rocket ship to hell, going by the lamentably predictable gushing tributes to her legacy which have emanated from Washington, London, Brussels, etc., you would think that she died a martyr for women's rights and decency. If anything, it comes as further evidence of the chasm which separates servants and apologists for empire from its countless victims and casualties. It also leaves us in no doubt that people in the West are led by men and women for whom brutality is a virtue and compassion a vice. The sanctions imposed on Iraq for 13 years between 1990 and 2003 were positively medieval in scope and in their impact on Iraqi society. A 1998 analysis of this impact produced by the UK charity Emergency Nutrition Network revealed that, as a direct consequence, 109,720 people died annually between 1990 and 1994. Half a million Iraqi children died or were made ill. 1 million children under the age of 5 suffered malnourishment. Mortality in under 5-year-old Iraqi children rose 600% between 1990 and 1994, while there was a 500% increase in low birth weight infants and a doubling of infant mortality in Baghdad, specifically over the same period. We could go on, but by now you get the drift. The sanctions imposed by the United Nations Security Council on Iraq under the auspices of the UN Security Council Resolution 661 and heartily defended by Madeleine Albright constituted a crime of such historic magnitude it would have shamed Genghis Khan. Indeed, so cruel and punitive were the sanctions on Iraq that not one but two UN aid coordinators appointed to Iraq, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, resigned in protest. It should be pointed out that Madeleine Albright's legacy is not completely dominated by her stance on the killing of Iraqi babies and infants. She has a river of Yugoslav-Serbian blood on her hands too, given the fanaticism with which she pushed for the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999. Let us not forget, Washington and its allies did so without bothering with the inconvenience of seeking United Nations Security Council approval beforehand, knowing in advance that Russia and China would veto any such proposal. The grim result was that for 78 days between 24th of March and 10th of June 1999, NATO aircraft pounded both military and civilian targets, including bridges, electricity-generating power plants, water processing plants, the headquarters of Yugoslavia's state-owned broadcaster in Belgrade, and even the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. It was the first time Belgrade had been bombed from the air since the Nazis bombed the city in 1941 over its status as a key locus of Yugoslav resistance to German occupation. By the end, Serbian authorities estimated that 2,500 people had been killed, with a further 12,500 injured. In addition, 25,000 homes and apartment buildings were damaged, and 470 kilometers of roads and 600 kilometers of railway lines were destroyed. Not for nothing was this military demarche under the flag of NATO described as Madeleine's War. She was its most zealous advocate within a Clinton administration that was chock full of liberal interventionists, expensively clad people for whom morality was measured not in championing the virtues of peace, but in pushing for war. In Madeleine Albright's case, this was confirmed during a 1993 meeting she had as Washington's United Nations ambassador with the head of the US military at the time, Colin Powell. In response to Colin Powell's argument that military action should only be taken after a clear political goal had been set, Albright came back at him with the following gem. "What's the point of having this superb military that you're always talking about if we can't use it?" Madeleine Albright goes to her grave at the age of 84, one of the most notorious war criminals of the modern era. That Barack Obama saw fit to present her with a Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2012 was no surprise. After all, they do say that it takes one to know one. Arriving in America as a child refugee from war-torn Europe in the 1940s, Madeleine Albright rose through the ranks in Washington to become one of the most servile apostles of U.S. hard power, responsible thereby for creating countless war refugees in turn. If only Western ideologues did get the irony, the world would be a far better place. American journalist Don DeBar said that George W. Bush also honored her as an American hero. Between the three of them, Bush, Albright, and Obama, killed more people in Iraq than the Soviet Union have killed since the Second World War. He said, "So while we're talking about dragging people to The Hague, we might start with the survivors of that set." Madeleine Albright was born in Prague and came to the United States as a refugee in 1948 after a communist coup in Czechoslovakia. After the Second World War, her father, a diplomat and academic who opposed communism, moved the family to the United States, where he taught international studies at the University of Denver in Colorado. Condoleezza Rice, the second female Secretary of State in 2005 under Republican President George W. Bush, was one of the students of Madeleine Albright's father in Denver. Albright told the New York Times in 2006, "It is quite remarkable that this Czech emigre professor has trained two secretaries of state."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Following one of the largest retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a and other major cities to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The Yemeni people are free. 7 years of crime have passed against us, but this has been matched by 7 years of steadfastness, freedom, and defeat of the enemy. The Yemeni army has manufactured weapons, including ballistic missiles and drones, and this is by the grace of God. And as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, now a new phase of confrontation with the Saudi enemy will begin. Our big gathering today is to confirm that we will remain steadfast until we win and expel the occupier.
The protesters expressed their support for the army's recent aerial operations, saying the Saudis only understand the language of force and it is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense against Riyadh's war and siege.
All the Yemeni people are supporting the operations which has been against the Saudi facilities, economic and facilities, and also military facilities. We are revenging violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the 8th year of the war will be different, as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Avlatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression. In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the yellow vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election. France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to bush the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations. Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and wars since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the world's watching in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it stuck with its war in Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Thursday, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian arrived in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese officials. Abdollahian expressed his country's willingness to provide aid to Lebanon in different fields, especially in the economic and commercial sectors.
Almost a month ago, I met with Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati in the Munich summit, and I informed him about the Islamic Republic of Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in building two power plants, where each would provide 1,000 megawatts of electricity. This is in addition to Tehran's readiness to cooperate with Lebanon in economic development and other fields.
Abdollahian met with top Lebanese officials to discuss bilateral ties as well as latest developments in the region. President Michelon stressed during his meeting with the Iranian minister that any progress in the Vienna talks as well as negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have positive impacts on the region and the world. During his talks with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri and Prime Minister Miqati, Abdollahian touched upon the significance of the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon. As Lebanon is dealing with economic crisis, some experts believe U.S. bans on any dealing with other Asian states, especially Iran, has exacerbated Lebanon's problems.
The U.S. pressure and the Western country against the Iranian commitment to help Lebanese people in supporting their living, of daily living, this is what prevents the Lebanese government from receiving the funds and the support of the Iranian people and Iranian government. As people and as local authorities in Ghubayri, we welcome for any support coming from the Iranian people, first of all, and the Iranian government for the sake of better survival.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also held a meeting with the Iranian minister where they discussed developments in Lebanon and the region. Abdollahian met with Palestinian factions and reiterated Iran's support for the full liberation of Palestine. The Iranian foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic of Iran's previous calls to build two electricity stations, which could substantially resolve Lebanon's energy crisis. However, Lebanese officials seem reluctant to face U.S. intimidations and work with Iran, or even China for that matter, to change Lebanon's dire conditions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example.
When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax